Hello, and welcome to Juno Afternoon on KTOO News Juno. I'm Joan Partis, your host. Jeff Brown is the engineer and producer of the show, and we've got a great show. We'll be talking about 360 North Productions highlighting the 50th anniversary of the Alaska Marine Highway. We'll be hearing about astronaut humor that's going to go on tomorrow night at the planetarium, and we'll talk with Mireille New, who about her year-long residency at Moscow's Bolshoi Ballet Academy, and we'll learn about a new Klingit language app. And Katrina Pearson and Colleen Mondor will be here to profile their new publishing business, Surefast Editions. Stay tuned.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. In Canada, the Truth and Reconciliation Week in British Columbia came to an end over the weekend. A march held in Vancouver included a keynote speech from the daughter of a U.S. civil rights leader. Dan Karpinchuk has more.
Thousands of people braved the pouring rain on Sunday to take part in the Reconciliation Walk. It came at the end of a week of hearings by the Federal Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Ian Campbell is the hereditary chief of the Squamish Nation.
And this is truly beautiful on this day that the Creator is cleansing us with this beautiful rainfall, the nurturing, life-giving water that sustains everything on all life on earth. That is why we are here today, is to cleanse and to reconcile.
Meanwhile, support for the victims came from the daughter of the slain American civil rights leader, Martin Luther King. Bernice King was the keynote speaker. She said her father taught people about nonviolent social change.
The way forward means that we must embrace this philosophy, where one resists evil and opposes unjust systems that seek to oppress and minimize, degrade and degenerate people.
King said economic empowerment is a key for First Nations. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission was set up as part of a settlement between the Canadian government, victims and churches who operated the residential schools for more than a century until the last one closed in 1996. The aim of the schools was to assimilate Native children into white society. The children were forced to attend the schools, but thousands were physically, sexually, or emotionally abused. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Protests were held across the U.S. over the weekend objecting to the Keystone Pipeline Project. As Jim Kent reports, Native people joined in a walk in South Dakota.
The amalgamation of the Lakota men's group, Wicha Agli, the Rosebud Sioux Tribes Shielding the People organization, and the Cowboy Indian Association is intended to create a stronger front to battle the proposed Keystone XL pipeline, says event organizer Wayne Frederick. The Lakota husband and father sees the unification of diverse groups as the key to fighting Keystone, since the project's path will disrupt many families in the surrounding communities and on the Rosebud Sioux Reservation.
There's going to be 200 to 500 man camps skirting scattered tracts on the reservation in Tripp County.
Man camps are temporary living compounds for crews on construction sites that can severely impact the infrastructure and services of nearby communities. Although denied permission by the city of Winter to hold their walk in the streets due to the town's homecoming celebration, the group held their protest by walking on the sidewalks instead. Frederick says the primary goal of the walk was to hand out informational flyers to community members that would allow them to make their own decisions about the Keystone XL pipeline instead of just accepting what the TransCanada Corporation has been telling them. Frederick adds that although this was the first major protest against the Keystone XL pipeline in the Winter area, it won't be the last. For National Native News, I'm Jim Kent.
Native people from the Standing Rock Reservation were among about 300 people who marched and protested Sunday in the small town of Leith as white nationalists held a meeting. Attorney Chase Iron Eyes is from the nearby tribal community.
It's too close for us, for the Standing Rockers, you know, the native people that were there, who we came with in a caravan. It's just too close to home. We have, there's a couple of bars and a couple of other public establishments that are well within 30 miles of where these guys want to put a white supremacist colony. And we can't risk a future negative interaction with any of these guys.
News reports indicate Craig Cobb has bought land with the intention of creating a white nationalist community in the North Dakota town. During this month in 1978, Mesa Verde National Park in Colorado was designated a UNESCO World Heritage Site. The park protects ancestral Pueblo cliff dwellings and archaeological sites. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Hello, you're listening to Juno Afternoon. It's Monday, September 23rd. The weather the rest of today is numerous showers, highs around 58, southeast wind 10 to 20 miles per hour. Tonight, numerous showers in the evening, becoming scattered showers late, lows around 46, southeast wind 10 miles per hour, becoming light in the late evening. Tuesday, mostly cloudy. Tuesday night, partly cloudy. Wednesday, increasing clouds. And then we move right into rain. So here we are. It's once again, Monday, September 23rd. Jeff Brown is the producer and engineer of the show, and I am your Monday host, Joan Pardis. And our first guests today are Kelly Birkinshaw from 360 North Productions, KTOO, and John Gitkov. Welcome, guys.
Thank you.
Welcome. Nice to be here.
And they're here to talk about, if you didn't catch it, there is a four-part series airing on 360 North called Alaska Marine Highway. It also had some national play in many different states. It's going to re-air this Wednesday and be followed. There was, the first initial part was shown a couple of months ago, and now that is going to re-air, followed by three consecutive parts. So it's a four-part series, and it's all about the history, celebrating the 50 years of the Alaska Marine Highway. Is that correct, Kelly?
That's correct, yeah. The second one is the voyage of the Malaspina's golden voyage up the Inside Passage, and then the third and fourth focus on what it's like to live on board and work on board, and then the fourth is, the connections that the ferries help us make to all the people in the communities on the coast of Alaska.
That's great. So once again, the first part that already aired is going to start this Wednesday, and then it's each Wednesday afterwards. So Kelly, how did this project come about?
Well, our own Jeff Brown actually had the brainchild there and suggested it. And then, Tim Olson, the executive producer, was phenomenal to be able to go out and get support. And we got support from, the Alaska Marine Highway, and also Travel Alaska, the Southeast Conference, and the Port of Bellingham. And without their support, this really wouldn't have taken off.
Right, right. And I've heard, I haven't seen it, so I'm really excited that it's re-airing, but I've heard a lot of really great things about it. There's definitely a buzz in Juneau, and it's great that it's getting national play, too, so we could let our friends and neighbors know, hey, this is how we live up in Southeast Alaska.
Yeah.
And talking a little bit about that, John Gitkov, his dad was the captain on one of the original ferries here in Juneau. Is that true?
Yes, he was.
Okay. So tell us a little bit about that. You were saying this was back in territorial days.
During the territorial
times,
they had we moved down here from Antioch in 1952. I was just like a baby, so tells you how young I am. And he was hired to be a captain on the Chilkoot that ran between T Harbor and Haines, and sometimes the Skagway. And then later on, he ran that for a few years, and then it switched over to the Chilkat, which was owned by the state of Alaska, and he captained it and also managed it. So he had hired the crew, the groceries, sold the tickets, or hired people to sell the tickets, and operated out of T Harbor to Haines and Skagway. And it was a fun thing growing up, seeing this happen.
I bet. You were saying that you had five sisters, and that sometimes he would just blow the horn when he was coming into the port, and your mom would go grab him at T Harbor.
Yeah, we lived about 5 miles north of T Harbor, so it was dirt road and all that, and we had a Willys Jeep and only one car family, and he'd wail on the horn, and that we'd wave the flag, or we had some towels we'd wave, and that meant we knew, and she would drive to T Harbor. Normally, most of us kids would pack in and greet the ferry when it tied up and pick them up. And it was neat. Talk to the passengers as they came off and it left a pretty neat impression on you growing up.
I would imagine. So how long did your pop do that?
It was basically 11 years. He did it the whole time we lived in Juneau, basically, and I left here when I was 11. Went to the Caribbean for a while, but came back.
Welcome back.
It's nice to be back.
Must be the weather. So that's just a little snapshot of the very, very beginning of the ferry system, where it sounds like it was a contract, like, here, you have a boat, why don't you just do this, is kind of what it sounds like.
And you'd bid on it.
Yeah. And so if you're interested to know more about the history of the Alaska Marine Highway, Kelly, what are the dates and times and all that stuff?
This Wednesday, the 25th. At 8 p.m. and it re-airs on Sundays at 7 p.m.
That's great to know. And then it will be consecutive. It will be a four-part series.
Four-part series. So it finishes up on October 20th.
Okay. And I think the series is also available for sale through KTOO. Is that true?
That's correct. Right now you can buy the first of the series, and then the other three will be available soon.
Okay, great. All right. Well, thanks for coming in. We're going to take a short break and be back with our next guest.
Okay. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 23rd of September, 2013. It was on this day, 1806, Lewis and Clark, Meriwether Lewis, William Clark, returned to St. Louis after their expedition. 2.5 years, 8,000 miles, they traveled all the way to the Pacific Ocean and back, exploring the new Louisiana Territory for Thomas Jefferson. They each kept detailed journals, so we know a lot about their trip. They had left St. Louis in the spring of 1804, spent the first winter at a camp on the Missouri in what is now North Dakota. They set off west in May of 1805 after they had sent a boat back to St. Louis with some of the members of the expedition who they did not particularly need, they realized, and who carried in the boat reports for Jefferson and some letters to friends and family and all sorts of objects, skeletons and skins and dried plants and rocks. There were some Indian artifacts, cooking pot, bow and arrows, buffalo skin, and there were live animals they sent back, 4 magpies and a sharp-tailed grouse and a prairie dog which they had kept alive in a cage. The boat traveled down the Missouri, down to St. Louis, and then another boat took the stuff to New Orleans, and then a ship took it to Washington, D.C., where it reached Thomas Jefferson in August. And then there was no further word from them until this day in 1806. They came through St. Charles, Missouri. People were astonished to see them. They thought they'd all disappeared and were dead. Got back to St. Louis, and Meriwether Lewis wrote a letter to Jefferson, a letter that took almost a month to reach the president in Washington, in which Lewis wrote, "In obedience to your orders, we have penetrated the continent of North America to the Pacific Ocean, and sufficiently explored the interior of the country to affirm with confidence that we have discovered the most practical route which does exist across the continent by means of the navigable branches of the Missouri and Columbia rivers." From St. Louis, fall 1806, they made their way to Louisville, and from there to Virginia and to Jefferson's home in Monticello. It's the birthday of the poet Euripides, born near Athens in the year 480 B.C., who probably wrote about 92 plays, 19 of which have been preserved. It was the Greek playwright who portrayed the gods as being much darker, petty, uncaring, and one of the first writers to treat women as major characters. And it's the birthday of Bruce Springsteen, Freehold, New Jersey, 1949, played in a number of bands with names like The Rogues, The Steel Mill, Dr. Zoom, and The Sonic Boom. His album Born in the USA, 1984, was one of the best-selling albums of all time. Here's a poem for today by Mary Oliver, "How It Is With Us and How It Is With Them." We become religious, then we turn from it, then we are in need, and maybe we turn back. We turn to making money, then we turn to the moral life, then we think about money again. We meet wonderful people, but lose them in our busyness. We're, as the saying goes, all over the place. Steadfastness, it seems, is more about dogs than about us. One of the reasons we love them so much. A poem by Mary Oliver, How It Is With Us and How It Is With Them, from her collection Dog Songs, published by Penguin and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by LendingTree, where you can fill out one form and receive up to 5 loan offers at trylendingtree.com, NMLS 1136. Produced by Joy Biles, with assistance from Kathy Roach. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Juno employers, do you want to decrease employee turnover, lower health care costs, and improve your bottom line? Supporting breastfeeding women in the workplace makes it easy for new mothers to come back to work. A support program can be simple and can benefit your business as well as your employees. Contact a workplace breastfeeding consultant for a free consultation at 500-8871 or JunoBreastfeedingAlliance.org. Sponsored by Juno Family Health and Birth Center and Search.
Hello, you are listening to KTOO News Juno, and this is Juno Afternoon. I'm Joan Pardis. Jeff Brown's the producer and engineer of the show. And in the studio right now is Steve Kosis from the Planetarium. Hello, Steve. How are you?
Hi, Joan and Jeff. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, so thanks for coming. After the autumn equinox yesterday, you've come in to talk a little bit about what's going on tomorrow night. So what is going on tomorrow night in the ongoing program at the Marie Drake Planetarium?
Well, the Marie Drake Planetarium is on Glacier Avenue downtown, and it's right behind that large artificial turf playing field, the 12-foot high fence. There's 2 double glass doors you enter. And 6:30 p.m. tomorrow, Christina De La Rosa will be doing the keynote talk on astronaut humor. And astronaut humor will both be both serious and irrelevant. And we'll talk about the properties that astronauts, who are both male and female, should have, the teamwork, the humor, the knowledge to be an astronaut.
The right stuff, as you were saying before.
Yes, that's the Tom Wolfe novel, and it was made into a film.
It was. It's a good film.
So that'll be covered, too.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, wow. And then it will be plus the stars tonight on the Spitz projector, correct?
Yes. Juno has actually the largest planetarium in Alaska, and it's also the largest planetarium from Seattle to Fairbanks. And it's made in USA, Spitz, 1967, Pennsylvania.
And all their programs are free.
That's true. And all ages are welcome. And we have a group of volunteers. Christine will be doing the main talk, Astronaut Humor. And then Clark Branch will be operating the Spitz projector for the stars tonight, which is what the night sky would look like if it was clear, which I don't think it's going to be tomorrow night.
Not according to the monitor I have in front of me.
That is true.
You never know. So that's 6:30 tomorrow night. And then yesterday was the autumn equinox. That was yesterday?
Yes, it was.
Sunday. So, and you were saying it was at 11:44 a.m. So what is the significance of the autumn equinox?
Well, the equinox is midway between the June solstice and the December solstice. So if you were in Quito, Ecuador, which is on the equator, yesterday, at local noon in Quito, Ecuador, the sun would be directly overhead, which is called the zenith. So the sun is midway between its furthest position north and its furthest position south at the equinox. There's 2 equinoxes in the year. There's the September equinox and the March equinox.
Okay. And I would imagine at some point in time that this would be how you would mark a calendar or how you would move forward, as opposed to like living in southeast Alaska. And now that the rain's here, we know the rain's here until the snow comes. Is that true?
That is true.
There's something along those lines.
I agree.
Okay. So that was autumn equinox yesterday. And then our next big event, it would be solstice.
Exactly.
And what is the exact date of solstice? Is it 21? Is it 22?
Well, the December solstice is usually given in universal time. So in the 48 states, it would be December 22nd. But here in Alaska, I think this year it would be December 21st at our time zone. We're, of course, 4 hours behind Eastern time.
Correct. Correct. So once again, Tuesday, tomorrow night, 6:30 at the Marie Drake Planetarium, Christina De La Rosa will be doing the keynote, which is Astronaut Humor, properties a person should and should not have to be an astronaut. And then they will go right into the Stirs tonight on the Spitz projector. So thanks so much for coming by.
Thank you, Joan, and thank you, Jeff.
Woke up this morning with light in my eyes, and then realized it was still dark outside. It was a light coming down from the sky. I don't know who or why. Must be those strangers that come every night. Those saucer-shaped lights put people uptight. Leave blue-green footprints that glow in the dark. I hope they get home all right. Hey, Mr. Spaceman, won't you please take me along? I won't do anything wrong. Hey, Mr. Spaceman, won't you please take me along for a ride? Woke up this morning, I was feeling quite weird. Had flies in my beard, my toothpaste was smeared. Over my window, they'd written my name. Said, so long, we'll see you again. Hey, Mr. Spaceman, won't you please take me along? I won't do anything wrong. Hey, Mr. Spaceman, won't you please take me along for a ride? Won't you please take me along? I won't do anything wrong. Hey, Mr. Spaceman, won't you please take me along for a ride?
Hello, you're listening to KTOO News, Juno Afternoon. I'm Joan Pardis, and I'm in the studio with Marie New, and it's really nice to have her back. She came into the studio. Marie's 16 years old. She's a dancer. She started ballet when she was 12, which is older for a ballerina. She came and talked to us before she went for a trip to Russia through the State Department this summer, and also did a summer intensive with the Bolshoi. Am I pronouncing that right?
Yes.
Bolshoi Ballet in New York. And out of the 15 U.S. students, she was picked. There were three that were picked to do a year-long study at the Bolshoi Academy, which was created in 1776, I think
yes.
it was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So anyway, let's talk about your Russian experience this summer. So did you stayed with a Russian family?
Mm-hmm. On the weekends. During the week, we stayed at the Bolshoi Academy.
And what was the Bolshoi Academy like?
It was phenomenal. It was so amazing to be in this place that so many of my ballet inspirations and heroes have trained at and grown up, and there's just so much history there. It's really amazing.
Is the architecture, like, if I would close my eyes and think about it, I would just think, wow, it must have so much history. It must be such a beautiful building. Is that
yes,
true?
It's very beautiful. The studios are gorgeous.
That's great. So you stayed with a Russian family on the weekends. During the week, you were in a rigorous program where I understand that you danced for 4 hours, you studied Russian language for 4 hours, and then you also did other things.
Yes, we had cultural excursions in the evenings.
And what would that be?
So we would go out. One night we went to the embassy, the U.S. embassy in Russia. One night we went, we were given a tour of Slava Zaitsev's fashion house. He's this very famous Russian fashion designer. We really did so many things. One night we went to Zurab Tsurteli. He made the statue of Peter the Great on the Moscow River. We got to paint in his studio. We really did a vast variety of different experiences. It was amazing.
It sounds amazing. What is Moscow like? What is Moscow 2013 like?
It's very big. It has a very efficient metro system. It's really amazing to me. The people there have such a passion for life and for the arts, and ballet is so much a part of the culture on the street. you know, at any old matryoshka stand, there will be ballerinas on boxes, and people really have this high respect for the arts that's quite different from the U.S.
What is a matryoshka stand?
A matryoshka doll is like the classic Russian stacking dolls.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yep. So you'll see them sold all over the streets and just to different places.
Okay. So you spend time in New York and New York City, and then you spend time in Moscow. Are there any similarities? I mean, they're both very large cities. They're both very metropolitan. Is Russia something that you can't compare to a U.S. city?
I think in some ways, yes. Definitely very similar in the way that most people get around by public transportation. Lots of people walk places, take the metro. There's a wide variety of restaurants and things to do. There's a park called Gorky Park, which is quite similar to Central Park. There's bikes you can rent. There's bean bags that people lay on the grass. There's different music events. So that in that way, it's similar that there's many, many activities for people in the city.
Right. And is it as fast as, like, is it as, it's an urban
yes.
center, so
yes.
it moves fast
yes,
as well.
Yes, it does.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. And so you're going back, and when do you go back?
About a week. I'm hoping to start classes there on October 1st, but I have to get the visa, and it's a very extensive process, so we'll see, hopefully.
And the year goes from October 1st until when?
Until May or June, depending on when your year-end exams are. And I'll be back here for Christmas break.
That sounds great. And this is obviously a very large honor. Three people from the United States have been picked for the program. Is that
yes.
true?
Mm-hmm.
And how is your Russian coming along? How is it being immersed
it's
in
it? Polka.
What does that mean?
It's not bad. It's coming. it's a very hard language, but it's very beautiful, and I love it. So I'm really excited to go back and keep speaking it and learn more.
Okay. So I'm going to do a little name dropping. Your mom's in the hall, so I'm just going to have to do it for her, I think. But you went to the Joffrey Ballet. You went to a summer intensive to the Joffrey Ballet.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're going to the Bolshoi Ballet. And even if you're not in the ballet community, I think everybody knows those are pretty big names. So when a 16-year-old who turned 17 finishes a year at the Bolshoi Academy, a ballet academy, mm-hmm. what's next?
Well, what I'm hoping to have happen, there's different courses at the academy. There's a course of training that's a few years long, so you study for 2 or 3 years, depending on what course you're in, and then you get a diploma and you graduate. It's like graduating high school, but ballet. So hopefully I'll be able to train there for a few years if I can make the financial ends meet and if I get it asked back next year. After you graduate, I would hope to go on to a company. And I'm not sure which company yet, but after I graduate, I'd like to find a job as a professional ballerina.
That sounds great, and that sounds very feasible considering how much training you're getting.
Thank you.
So the next step, because that was really, I was ignorant, so I didn't really know what the next step was. So the next step is you would really like to get into their official program that has a degree, their degree
yes.
program.
Mm-hmm.
That would be your first choice. And if it's not that, I would imagine that there are other degree programs that you could pursue besides the Bolshoi Ballet.
Yes,
is that
course.
Correct?
Mm-hmm.
So
yes.
great. Mm-hmm. Okay, so how do you say congratulations in Russian?
Well.
Do you know?
I mean.
Or good
I guess
luck?
It's different. I mean, udachi is good luck. I guess when we say congratulations, I've never actually said that. I suppose I would say очень хорошо, very good, or молодец, that's excellent. Udachi is good luck.
Udachi is the best I could do with my 10-minute lesson.
You, but thank
so,
you.
Udachi. And when you come back for the Christmas holidays, come back and let's talk more because I'd love to hear about this.
Yeah, I'd love that.
We have a very busy show, but it would be really, really interesting. And are you going to be doing, like, any kind of blogging or is
yes,
that not?
Yes, I will. I will be having a blog. My blog is called Rainforest to Russia and Alaskan Sleep to the Bolshoi Ballet. You can just search it online. And then I also have a GoFundMe account because the tuition is incredibly expensive and it's, you know, very hard for my family to afford it. Of course, they're very supportive, but it's a huge expense. So if anyone would like to donate to that, I'd be very appreciative. Anything helps, even if it's just a dollar. So you can go to GoFundMe.com and search Mari New and Alaskan Sleep to the Bolshoi Ballet, and I'll also be posting updates on that throughout the year, so you can keep up with me there.
That sounds great. Thanks so much for coming in, and when you come back, please come on in and udoce.
Да. Was that correct? Молодец. Спасибо.
Okay, we'll have to speak English, but I'll learn a little more next time.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. Hello, you're listening to Juno Afternoon. I'm Joan Pardis. Jeff Brown is the producer and engineer of the show. And on the line with me right now is Simon Roberts. He's in Kluwak, and he just created an Alaska Native language app. Is that true, Simon?
Yes, I did. It's called Southern Tlingit One. It's the first Tlingit language app out there for iPhones and Androids.
That's great. Congratulations. You want to tell us a little bit about how this came about? I hear you've been working with your grandmother.
Yes, I've been working with my grandmother here locally in Kluwak on developing this year app. What sparked it into existence was last summer I was working on learning how to develop apps, and what really got me jumping into developing it was I seen that the Haidas for the Canadian side had a language app, and I seen nothing for the Tlingits or the Northern Haida or the Tsimshians up here, and so I started focusing all my attention on how to develop apps, especially for language, and that's how this year app came into existence.
That's not a lot of time. It seems like you heard about it last year, and then that really piqued your interest. Is it hard to create an app?
It is in a way, yes. There's a couple different ways to develop them. You can build them with code or without. These ones are built without code, but it did take a while to find the right companies to work with for this, because a lot of them will charge you a high dollar amount. Even though I do know how to build with some code, but to do what I would like with it, I would rather build on templates for the time being. But actually, I was sidetracked along the way. I had a lot of local companies that I've been developing apps for, from Native corporations to a lot of the float plane companies, creating them their own company apps or business apps as they heard what I was doing and decided to jump on board to have that, as they see websites are becoming obsolete and apps you hear about all the time of people saying, I get 1,000 downloads today and so forth.
Right.
So you don't hear about websites like that.
Right.
So I refocus my energy back towards the language. And so after I finish up the Southern dialect, I'm actually working with a local there in Juneau, Lance Twitchell from the university, to do Northern dialect Tlingit for the Haida language for the Northern Kaigani, Ben Young, and still confirming on for the Tsimshian language. But future projects, I've been speaking with Gary Holton from the University of Fairbanks. They would like to have me on board to help them out with their language projects.
That's great. Congratulations.
Thank you.
So it seems like you're kind of really a trendsetter here as far as doing the apps of Alaska Natives here in Alaska, even though you did hear about the first one through Canada. So that is really wonderful. But also, aren't you doing something with art as well, as far as slimline cases and iPhone leather wallets?
Yes, I am. I started a trend 2 years ago putting Clinkit art onto iPhone cases, and then within 3 months of it going viral on Facebook, all the other artists here in the Southeast started having their own iPhone cases out there, which kind of, since they have their ins and outs with their local vendors, it kind of came back on me, and so I wasn't able to get my cases out as much as I'd like to, because if they could work with someone local, they would pretty much do that. So that's actually about that time when I got done doing my cases and stuff, I started selling off. I had a radio station that you guys had interviewed me on this your same show a couple years ago. I launched the first Native American hip-hop radio station online. It's the largest out there still. Got them some apps and things like that. They built them a social network similar to Facebook. Sold it off beginning of last year, right when I was trying to figure out what I wanted to start working on next, and that's when apps kind of came into existence for me.
That sounds great. So let me ask you a question. You're doing so much from Kowak, which, of course, is a very small Southeast Alaska town, and I'm just wondering, what have you always been interested in technology? Is it something that, this was natural for you to weave culture and technology, or what was your path to get to where you are now?
That and a lot of autodidactism. I've always self-learned. I can find when I'm interested in something, I research everything about it and pretty much sum it up and try to make it as simple as possible for the steps to get there. Apps are, I see, as the latest thing out there, latest communications, and that was the reason why I wanted to get into it, was to get information out there. My long-term goal with the apps is to provide all the culture on these here apps, from having how-to apps, like how to carve, how to basket weave, how to make blankets and tunics, things like that, all the culturally heritage things from Tlingit Haida's and Tsimshian's. I've already started networking out with a lot of local artists that are doing those things to start taking pictures and videos and things like that, and writing out what are the steps in these processes so that I could be able to start working that direction. I'm hoping to establish something with the local tribal government here to work with them on getting grants for these here, because some of these here projects are going to cost the artist quite a bit of time to work on, so that's why I'm hoping to be able to establish grants to get these language apps out there. I've been pretty much doing it as an enterprise. I've just been selling billboard space on these apps. So, this first app was done by was sponsored by Brad Fletch over there in Juneau, who's runs Fortress Management Financial. He was excited about this year language project and came on board as the first sponsor for it. The second sponsor is actually out of Ketchikan, and the third one's here in Prince of Wales for the third app. The apps are done in levels, so that when you're learning them, after you learn the first step is more like household words. What gave me the idea to do household words was Rosetta Stone had always see the slogan saying, in order to learn a new language, think like a child. Well, I kept on asking myself, well, what do children learn first? Mom, dad, food, brother, sister, floor, hot, cold, things like that there. And so that's how I put the first words into existence for that app.
Yeah, that sounds great. So if I was, I haven't checked it out, but I'd like to. So if I was going to download Southern Tlingit 1, any words of advice from the maker as far as how to navigate it or how to use it? Or is I'm sure it's all pretty clear, but since I have you on the line.
I designed the app to be used with headphones, so if you tried to learn the language without the headphones, you won't get the pronunciations right. I didn't kind of the volume as loud as I wanted to on all of it, on each one of the recordings, so that it would force the user to use headphones so that it's more of a private one-on-one experience with it, and they're able to hear the correct spellings and pronunciations of each one of the words with the headphones on. That's about the only drawback I have from it, is I left the volume quiet. It's not that I didn't want to turn it up, or I didn't know how to turn it up. I was raised in my dad's recording studio growing up. That's actually what got me into radio later on, because I actually apprenticed under Jeff Brown over there in your office there a few years back before I launched my own online radio station.
Yeah, Jeff's in the studio with me right now. He's the engineer and producer of the show, so he's here smiling, remembering working with you too. So if we want to follow you, are you on Facebook? I mean, how could we keep posted about what's coming out of Kowak and the Simon Roberts world?
You could follow me on Facebook. It's under Simon Says, but replace every S in Simon Says with a Z, so Z-I-M-O-N-Z-A-Y-Z. And you could also find me on Twitter. And my mom runs Clinkett House, so anything that I come out with, she's always posting everything on Clinkett House on Facebook, too.
Alrighty.
So you're able to, long-term, what we're looking at for our... right now is actually sponsors to sponsor some of the other Northern and the Simpian apps is pretty much what we're hoping to get the message out there for.
Yeah, it sounds like a great project, and in a very short time, it seems to me, it probably didn't seem that short to you, but in very short time, it's up and running, and you have investors from throughout Southeast. So good luck in finding more to expand what you're doing. It sounds like a great project.
Thank you. All glad right. You guys had me on your show today.
Oh, anytime. Just give us a buzz when you have something else to talk about. And right now we've got to run, but thank you so much for sharing your time with us today.
You have a wonderful day there.
Okay, we're going to take a short break and be right back.
This is Bird Note. Listen, here's a hopeful sound. A bird. A hermit thrush has revived. It was rescued and placed in a paper bag after it struck a window while migrating. This morning, we're with Justin Sharp at Willowbrook Wildlife Center, west of Chicago. He's just received 28 injured or stunned birds, rescued by volunteers of Chicago Bird Collision Monitors. We're in a rehab unit with fans running for fresh air. Justin begins by taking two small bags, each containing a hermit thrush, into a screened enclosure.
What I'm going to do now is I'm going to test fly these birds, identify them, try to get their age and sex. We let them go in here and see how well they fly, do a quick visual exam on them, whether they have any obvious injuries. Eye injuries are common, that type of thing. If they do have some injury or they do not fly well enough, they will get checked into clinic. If they do fly well and nothing's, you know, visibly wrong with them, we will band them and release them right out here.
After the test, Justin says,
this hermit thrush didn't have very good flight, so this one's staying. He'll get checked in. They'll do a full exam in the clinic. Usually we put them on anti-inflammatory for head trauma, and we have little tiny bird doses. The other guy, the adult, he's good to go. So he will be banded and released.
Many birds aren't so fortunate, but for those that are, BirdNote celebrates wild bird rehabilitators everywhere. See how it's done at Willowbrook when you come to birdnote.org.
This is Mayor Merrill Sanford. One of the special things about living in Alaska's capital city is the amount of community involvement you'll find. People care about Juneau, and it shows every day as together we build a community. One way of taking part is to follow the activities of your assembly. If you can't make it down to our regular meetings, you can still follow the action live on KTOO News 104.3 on your FM dial. It's just another way of being involved. Thanks.
Democracy Now! Is a national, daily, independent, award-winning news program hosted by Amy Goodman. Pioneering the largest public media collaboration in the U.S., Democracy Now! Provides access to people and perspectives rarely heard, including independent and international journalists and ordinary people from around the world who are directly affected by U.S. foreign policy. You can hear Democracy Now! Weeknights at 9 on KTOO News Juno.
Hey kids ages 7 through 12, since there's no school next Thursday the 26th and Friday the 27th, come join Discovery Southeast for a day of outdoor adventure, fun, and learning. We are excited to study how the nature of Southeast Alaska prepares for winter, just like us. On Thursday we'll explore Douglas Island, and on Friday we'll investigate the beaches and terrestrial habitats near the Eagle Valley Center. Transportation from downtown and the valley will be provided. Call 463-1500 or visit the Discovery Days page at discoverysoutheast.org to register.
Hello, you're listening to Juno Afternoon. I'm your host, Joan Pardis. Jeff Brown is the producer and engineer of the show, and this is KTOO News Juno. In the studio with us right now is Christina Pearson from Juno, Alaska, and Colleen Mondor from Fairbanks, Alaska. And these two ladies have launched a new publishing company called Shorefast Editions that's based in Juno. Katrina has many years of decades of experience as a bookseller and author, events coordinator, publicist, and also Colleen has lots of background as a fellow bookseller and graduate student at the University of Alaska, and she's also an author of Map of My Dead Pilots, The Dangerous Game of Flying in Alaska, which was a 2012 NPR summer pick by Nancy Pearl. So thank you, ladies.
Thank you for coming in.
So, Katrina, why don't we talk with you? Tell us a little bit about your Juno roots and what you've done in the Juno community, and then we'll talk a little bit about Shorefest. How does that sound?
Sure, that sounds great. I'm Juno born, and most of my adult life I've been in the bookselling field, and I was the manager at Hearthside for many years, and I do some volunteer work in the community as well. I've never been able to get really out of the book industry in some way. I do also work for another publishing company as well. So Colleen and I worked together years ago in bookselling and reconnected after her book came out, and that's kind of how this idea that we could have our own small publishing company, that's how that idea was born.
Okay. And when small publishing company here in Alaska, it still has so many things that it could do. Like, are you reissuing books? Are you looking for new titles? So even just under the umbrella of Alaskan, it's a pretty wide umbrella. Which one of you want to tell us about what the umbrella really contains?
Well, it started primarily to reissue one specific out-of-print book, which is The Flying North by Gene Potter, which was originally published in 1945 and is the first and best book on Alaska's bush pilot history. It's incredibly important work, very readable work, and we had one of those phone calls where two friends are going back and forth, and you say, I can't believe this book is out of print. It's crazy this book is out of print. And usually one person in the phone call says, well, it's too bad. But in our case, we both said, let's bring this book back into print. And so we'll form a company, and we'll track down her family, and we'll figure out the copyright, and it's coming back into print. So initially, it was a reissue because we feel there's a lot of Alaskan books that have gone out of print that were not appreciated when they first came through and that people would really like to see again. Now we're also open to new books, and we're working on that as well.
Okay, so the book that was reissued is called The Flying North. It's by Gene Potter, and it, as you said, it was published originally.
1945.
Okay, are you a pilot?
Yes, I learned to fly when I was 18.
Okay, see, this is what happens when two booksellers get on the phone late at night and say, hey, what's going on? I think we should start a company. Okay, and then the next morning they say, really? Yeah, okay. Welcome to Alaska, right? Where anything is possible.
Right.
So, okay, so you reissued this book. You started a year ago. The book is coming out now.
It ships tomorrow. We got an email from the printer today.
Okay. So. And then what's the next step? So a publisher reissues a book, and then you find booksellers to sell it?
We do find booksellers to sell it. I work for Taku Graphics, and we will be handling the distribution of our books.
Okay.
So, I wanted to point out an important thing about Shorefast, and when we came up with this kernel of an idea over that crazy phone call, is that it was important to us that it was an Alaska company and as collaborative as possible, right? So we wanted to make sure, like, if you look at the cover illustration of this book, this is Courtney Birdsall Clifford, an artist out of Skagway, and so we wanted to incorporate Alaskan art and wonderful book design. Our book, this edition was designed by Sarah Asper Smith, who's a Juno person, and so that was important, to include as many Alaskans in that process as possible.
Okay, so still back to the process. So
yes.
The publisher publishes the book,
yes.
And then you have a distributor.
Correct.
Yes. And then who is your target audience? So So who's, what is the market that you said this book
for this specific
right,
title?
This book needs to get back into print. It has to get into people's hands.
This book has two separate audiences. One, which would be obvious for most Alaskans, is tourists, obviously. People who come up here, the Alaskan bush pilot myth and the idea of the Alaskan bush pilot is huge. And they want to see and learn as much about it as possible. But what is really important about The Flying North is this is well-written, funny, and also intense Alaskan history. So this is Ben Eielson, this is Joe Crossan, this is Bob Reeve, Harold Gillam. If they were alive, she talked to them. If they were dead, she talked to the guys who knew them. So it's anybody who's interested in Alaskan history in this state, but primarily the aviation community, it's a very important work. So we see the best thing about The Flying North is not only is it a book for people from outside, but it's for Alaskans. And that's the way she wrote it, and that's who she wrote it for. So it's got a good audience either way.
That sounds great. And so are you looking at other out-of-print titles right now to reissue, or are you pursuing new works?
We do have another book coming out at the end of the year.
Mm-hmm. It's a new book. Go ahead.
And it's going to be it's Beers of the North, a field guide to Alaska and the Yukon, and it's more of kind of a quirky travel guide. And then we have a couple of books projects slated for spring that we probably shouldn't quite mention.
That sounds good. So this is a question from Jeff, the producer of the show, is why in this, which I'm supposed completely supporting him, just saying it was his brilliant question, not mine.
Yeah, I can feel what the question is.
Why in this age of e-books are you choosing to print hard copies?
One of the aspects of publishing was the realization that if we wanted to have a physical book, that the design needed to be beautiful and amazing and something that someone would want to hold in their hand. And for us, you know, even though we are both participants in the e-book, you know, the advent of the e-book, a physical book and the tactile nature of the book was important to us.
Right.
It's the book succeeds. Our intention is that our books will succeed not only as a good reading experience, but as an object as well.
Right.
And people will want them in that context, although they will be available as e-books.
Yeah, right.
Also.
That's true.
And also your target audience, if it is tourists and Alaskans as well, the tourists, they'll take it home. And mm-hmm. I'll tell you about my book group, and I have a writing group. There are books that you read, and there are books that you buy.
Yes,
and
yes.
And I'll drop some names right now. The Snow Child by Ewan Ivey. Raven's Gift by Don Reardon. So there's some books that you just need to have.
Right.
And what those books are to each person is a different thing. And it's interesting because when I first bought my e-reader, I was like, I don't know if I'm ready to give up books, you know. And of course, the person is point of sale contact. I was up in Anchorage, you know,
right.
Point of sale contact. And they were just like, well, you're not going to give up books. You know, you're not going to give up your hard copies. This is just another way to do it. You're still going to have books.
Right.
So I guess that's what you're looking about, that you're talking about getting the piece of the mind or the heart that actually needs to have this book.
In this one, The Flying North also has photos in it. It is illustrated with archive photos, the starting of each chapter from Alaska State Library, UAA, UAF, of the bush pilots. They're gorgeous pictures. That is something that misses on an e-book. You lose the cover. The photos are not quite there. So we did what we felt was significant to make it a successful object as well as a read.
Right.
So.
And as a new company, as a new publishing house here in Alaska, does the e-book factor really weigh heavy on the decisions you make, or is it just kind of out there?
You know, it's sort of just hanging around out there. I mean, our first intent was to publish the hard copy and really nail the design of the piece, I think.
Mm-hmm. See how it goes from here.
Okay. And we're probably going to have to wrap up pretty soon, but in any given year, how many titles do you hope to publish?
2 to 4.
Yes, I agree.
Between 2 and 4.
Yeah, I just pushed a strategic plan right here. Right here.
We've been talking about it, but between 2 and 4.
Exactly. So let's talk, if we could take a sidestep from SureFast Editions, and if you want to check it out, they have a nice website, just search for it. Taku Graphics. How does Taku Graphics go into the publishing world? Is it a distributing arm exclusively?
It's a distribution company. It's technically an Alaskan art wholesale company where we represent over 100 artists, and at the same time we also distribute lines of different items, gift items, and we do distribute lines of books.
Okay.
It was a natural fit.
Exactly. And then, Colleen, let's talk a little bit about what are you doing up in Fairbanks?
We live there.
You live there?
We're both in Two Rivers, which is for Juneau people right outside of Fairbanks. And then we're also outside in the lower 48 for part of the year as well. Fairbanks has already gotten snow, so that weighs heavily on us. But my husband was a commercial pilot up here for years. He started with Mark Air Express, and he finished out with Frontier before they became ERA. So he and I met up there. I went up there to work for Aviation Company, and that's what Map of My Dead Pilots is from. It's the 4 years that I worked for dispatch for a Bush commuter in Fairbanks, and he and I actually met on the job. So now we have an aircraft leasing company, which is completely separate from all the rest of this.
Right. So. And are you still, I have your bio here, are you still blogging? Are you still a column? Can we, like, check out some of your work online?
Sure. My website is called chasingray.com, and that's where the information on Map of My Dead Pilots is. And it's been out for about, it'll be 2 years in November. It's in paperback now.
Mm-hmm. So that's Chasing Gray. Chasing Ray, all together. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Chasing Ray. Or I saw it actually, Chasing. Yeah, Chasing Ray. Chasing, chasingray.com. So do you have another book?
I am working on another book. It's Alaskan Again, Pilots Again. I've been in aviation since I was 18 years old, and it's not going away. So, and there's a lot to write about up here.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
I do, I cover it actually for Alaska Dispatch right now. I do the Bush Pilot blog there, so...
That's fun. And are you still doing the literary magazine? Are you still doing a column for the
I am. I review for the American Library Association, and then I also have a column at a website called bookslut.com, which sounds awful but isn't.
Okay. So it sounds like the polar opposite of the American Library Association, but maybe it isn't.
You know, it's not. It's actually a very highbrow literary site, and it's one of those situations where somebody made up a title and went online, and then all of a sudden you're incredibly popular, and you have that name, and that's who you are. So we do really well there.
That sounds great. I'm going to check it out. So it sounds like something that you would say, what is this?
Yeah, we get a lot of that.
All right. Well, congratulations and good luck on your new endeavor. We're going to have to go, and I'm going to have to come back to end the show. But thanks for coming in today.
Yeah,
both
thank
of you.
For having us.
Show. Hello, you're listening to Juneau Afternoon. It's been a really interesting show. Thanks for joining us. Jeff Brown is the producer and engineer of the show. I'm your host, Joan Pardis. As far as weather, tonight cloudy. Tomorrow, decreasing clouds, patchy fog, and isolated showers. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy, patchy fog late. Wednesday, increasing clouds. Wednesday night, cloudy. Thursday, rain. And then Thursday night and Friday, showers. Friday night and Saturday on through Monday is rain likely. So once again, thanks for joining us. Martha Moore hosts tomorrow. She's got a good lineup. Thunder Mountain High School's production of Three Musketeers. Jeff Kirsch and Fracates are giving details about Saturday's Juno Douglas Little Theater's Writers Workshop. We get a preview of Perseverance Theater's current production, God of Carnage, which I hear is great. And Karen Smolin will be here to discuss career and technical education activities and an update on Saturday's Emergency Preparedness Expo. So thanks for joining us. Have a great day.